official embargo, and then medicine was also added as well.
I would say to all my fellow Americans, let us continue.
If a financial transaction takes place with American dollars abroad and an American bank is involved, that transaction is illegal. If a ship docks in Cuba to let off supplies that have been purchased legally by Cuba, that ship may not then proceed to an American port. It is a blockade that is unilateral only because no one else in the world wants to join the United States in this insane policy, but it is so extraterritorial in nature that it involves other countries whether they like it or not.
So Tim, the documentary argues that the embargo fails both the U.S. and Cuba. What were the reasons laid out in the film for this?
Well, it's a little vague. This section of the film is the bit that deals with the embargo probably most fully. I wanted it to be fleshed out a lot more. It dates back to a whole history of kind of government antipathy between Fidel Castro and a succession of American presidents. And we see them sort of ticked off one by one, if you like, and the relationship just deteriorates. I mean, it was pretty bad with Kennedy, and it just gets worse and worse. By George W. Bush, it's really shocking. I really thought that the film could have focused on that entirely, and that would have been a very valid approach. Instead, we get a lot of other bits and bobs of kind of other sort of facets of Cuban kind of politics and history. Anyone who hasn't visited Cuba might struggle to kind of get the hang of the politics there and to get the hang of what a complicated country it is and the complicated relationship between the people of Cuba and Castro in his day, and also between Cuban Americans and Castro, who had quite a hostile relationship to him. The film does bring all of that up, and I was, you know, in some ways grateful to be reminded of some of those things. So yeah, it was interesting to delve back into all of this subject. I've been to Cuba myself, and it reminded me of a lot that I learned when I was there.
A good point that you raise, actually. There is a lot of propaganda against Cuba, so this film perhaps serves as a good counter-narrative to that propaganda.
It does, up to a point. I sort of felt that sometimes it was being a bit sketchy about the specifics. I think there's some statistic that among imported goods into Cuba, still quite a lot comes from the USA, something between 6-7%, something like that. And you would think from this film that it was an absolute 0% blockade. So that kind of detail gets a little bit elided, I think, in the narrative.
And Helen, if I could turn to you now to shed more light on the embargo itself. Mm. It seems like from the documentary that the US was the only country in the world that had a problem with Cuba. And why were the reasons for this, and were they justified?
So after the revolution, it wasn't declared as socialist straight away. There was a period where there was tit-for-tat retaliations between the United States government and the Cuban government. So the process of nationalizations didn't take place until almost 2 years after the triumph of the revolution. And at the point where the Cuban government started to nationalize, they offered the foreign companies compensation based on the value that they had claimed their businesses were for tax purposes. And Canadian companies, French companies, they took the compensation. So that settled the claim. But in the United States, the Eisenhower government had told US companies not to accept compensation. Why? Because they were already planning the Bay of Pigs invasion, which obviously is inconceivable to them that it wouldn't work and they wouldn't be able to throw out the nascent revolutionary government. So that was, you know, the opportunity was to resolve those issues. And subsequently, the US blockade or embargo, depending on who's speaking, has been, you know, it's the pretext has been it's a punishment for these nationalizations, but the reality has been it's always been at the center of a larger program which is trying to achieve regime change in Cuba.
And Tim, how damaging was the embargo? The film touches on this quite a bit. To Cuban society, and what effect did it have as laid out in the documentary?
Well, yeah, it creates a kind of big divide in Cuba. I don't feel the doc really does enough of that, actually. And there are a lot of comparisons, interesting comparisons that could be made between kind of the American the welfare state and the Cuban welfare state, for instance, which the film just doesn't bother with. There are pros and cons of Cuban culture and life that I feel are left out. But I think perhaps what it would have been much better as is a much more focused one
Helen, the embargo itself, instead of Cuba falling down to it, actually, were they able to survive, and not only that, thrive?
They were able to survive, and, you know, let's be clear, in the initial period, that was thanks to the help from the Soviet Union. As you said, I focused my work on Che Guevara's economics, and, you know, he had a dream. He was in charge of industrialization, of taking the most advanced technology in the world and implementing that in Cuba, but of course that was cut off, because immediately the US government was contacting the Prime Minister of Britain and saying, you cannot sell equipment or transport, you know, or anything to Cuba. So they had a very extensive trade. By the time that the Soviet bloc collapsed, 85% of Cuba's trade took place with that part of the world. And so, you know, in a sense, that trade had protected Cuba from the US blockade, from the impact of the embargo, because it could still, it didn't affect that trade. It could still carry out. The Soviet Union, Eastern Germany and so on weren't going to pay any attention. But the real, the double whammy of the blockade was felt then in the 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet bloc. And that's when Cuba entered something called a special period in time of peace. And it was, that was my first experience of living in Cuba, was in the 1990s. And, you know, it was extraordinarily hard. Even if you had dollars, you know, there was, the pharmacies were empty, you know, food shops were empty, equipment just lay abandoned because they couldn't get the spare parts.
So the embargo was affecting the lives of everyday Cubans.
We made it, the United States policy, to assassinate Fidel Castro. This was our policy, to bring down the Cuban government.
By the summer of 1959, the CIA is working with some mobsters to try and kill Fidel Castro. Nixon just ordered the CIA to ratchet up their plots with the mafia. Pretty audacious plan. It's now been very well documented, but only in the last two or three years when the National Archives found some files that really helped to lay some of this stuff out for the first time.
Dr. Castro, an American magazine published a story this week which says that Dr. Castro really hates America.
Well, am I going to hate to the people of the United States? I don't hate anybody.
Someone who's not familiar with this subject, some of these revelations in the documentary might seem like a bombshell, really. And you would think some of these things were conspiracy theories, these plots to take down Castro. Tim, were you surprised by this and by some of the findings and evidence of the documentary?
I wasn't really surprised, because I've seen some of the films about Castro, for instance, and Oliver Stone made a film about him, and I've read books on the subject. This film does come down rightly very hard on the CIA and kind of presents it as sort of a banker-funded mafia with its own interests in the stock market at heart. And you see that the kind of successive attempts of the CIA to kind of unsettle the Castro regime and unseat him. And it goes as far as assassination attempts. But again, I would love to have seen much more specific evidence of that. You could really go into the details on that and kind of deal with it. We get a little bit of documentation, but really not very much. I feel as though it's the makings of a really compelling kind of conspiracy-themed doc on that subject, which is very different from the doc about the embargo that we're sometimes getting as well. So they kind of sit side by side a little bit uneasily. I did find that section of the film kind of picked up the pace a little bit. I'll give it that.
It was incredibly exciting and fascinating, actually, this part of the documentary. And Helen, if I could turn to you, just going back about the assassination attempts on Castro. I mean, according to another documentary, 638 Ways
which
to
I was
Kill
gonna mention,
Castro,
yeah.
Fabian Escalante claims that there have been over 600 times attempts on Castro's life over a span of 40 years.
Yeah.
Why were there so many attempts, and then why did they fail?
I think two things are important. One is that the US government has never understood what a revolution means, in the sense that they have such a sort of personalized politics. They felt like taking out Fidel would destroy what was a mass movement, a revolution. And secondly, because of what he represented, and that's another element I think is missing. You know, the fact that Cuba was able to implement free universal healthcare, education, access to culture and so on. And what does that say in exposing the US model, where they say, you know, you have to pay for healthcare, and if you don't, you're left to die in the street. So, you know, really the biggest threat that Cuba presented was not the Soviet missiles that were there in 1962, but the biggest threat was the sort of threat of an alternative form of development. And that's what, you know, the US was so afraid of contaminating the rest of Latin America.
And Tim, if I could turn to you, would you have any thoughts to add to what Helen just said involving with the film?
On the subject of this of spreading to Latin American domino theory stuff, I guess, that's an interesting one as well. And yeah, the degree to which Cuba could be a kind of like a ringleader in that sense. There are films about that as well, and there's obviously there are films about the Cuban Missile Crisis specifically.
Yeah.
There's 13 days is mentioned, the 13 days in which it
perhaps happened. What's unique about this documentary then, by first-time filmmaker Jerry Rice, is that she was so taken by this subject and she involves herself in the journey. So from the perspective of sort of a layman's point of view, this takes you on that that journey also.
It does. She starts off as quite a presence in the film, and you kind of get have the sense of her kind of journeying there and her, this conversation that she had with Castro on a bus. And then she sort of drops out of it, and it sort of tries to become a bit more of an overview, and she kind of comes back in a little bit at the end. But I don't want to be overly negative, because there are things of value here, but I feel as though the film is indecisive about whether it's a personal treatise on Cuba and on the embargo, or if it's more of a kind of impersonal overview of the subject. I think it never quite makes its mind up, and you can kind of sense the vagueness in it, because sometimes the film will transition from one subject area into another with a little bit of music thrown in just to kind of help us over the bumps. I felt as though there needed to be much more of a sense of structure. Perhaps she started the film too early and hasn't got enough material from the last couple of years. There have been a lot of changes, as we'll talk about, and perhaps what it's missing is that most recent stuff that would really have helped kind of build the argument a bit more forcefully.
I just
think, even in terms of the embargo, I mean, you know, people are talking about it in the past tense, especially since Obama announced rapprochement with Cuba.
President Trump will treat the Castro regime as a malevolent dictatorship that it is. Thank you, President Trump. You have not betrayed us. You kept your promise. I am so thrilled to be back here with all of my friends in Little Havana.
And you mark my words. And you mark my words. Whether it's in 6 months or 6 years, Cuba will be free.
We just didn't fight hard enough. Now, those days are over. Now we hold the cards. We now hold the cards. We will enforce the ban on tourism. We will enforce the embargo.
And Helen, as I noticed that you're shaking your head at Marco Rubio, why was that?
Marco Rubio has some leverage over Trump, and he seems to be playing the tune that Trump is dancing to at present. It's worth pointing, as a businessman, Trump sent his representatives to talk to the Cuban government about business opportunities in 1998, when it still was illegal before rapprochement, and also in the early 2000s. So Trump, with his businessman hat on, had, you know, said, I have no problem with lifting the embargo. And in fact, he said that at the beginning of his electoral campaign. But obviously, when he became a serious candidate, he had to do the done thing and go to Miami and win the support of the Rubios and the other Cuban-American politicians. And he obviously, you know, made deals with them.
Of course, Florida was a turning point in the election for Trump winning. Tim, if I could turn to you, how was Trump portrayed in this documentary, and is he shown as responsible for reigniting the hostility between the US and
Cuba? He is shown as doing that in that clip, which is pretty much the last 2 minutes of the film. That is it, what we've just seen. That's the only time we see Trump. What strikes me about that clip is that it's cut like a trailer. It was incredibly fast, and the footage was just flowing in. The music's really hammering this out. You could watch a 90-minute film just on that. And instead, we end with this kind of rapid-fire trailer montage of the harm that Trump has done. It really is all too hasty, I think. I wanted commentary on that. I wanted people talking about that. I wanted analysis of that. Instead, we just see his speech. We see it happening. And then we kind of go home and hope that things change.
But there's only so much time, I suppose, you can cram into a documentary.
Of course, yeah. But I just feel as though it's sort of it's biting off more than it can chew fundamentally. And I think if it had just focused a bit more, I think we would have a more valuable film. Yeah,
sorry, I just want to add, I mean, you know, like, under the Obama administration, there were more fines against third countries and companies in third countries.
But, of course, it wasn't Obama trying to ease relations with Havana.
He did too little too late. The U.S. embargo or blockade is codified in U.S. law. It can only be lifted by a vote in Congress. But as the president, he could issue executive decrees. And those he did issue on very limited basis to allow, you know, six airlines to fly from the United States to Cuba and a couple of hotels. But he could have gone far further, and he didn't. And in fact, you know, under Obama, the fines were some of the fines were astonishingly high. So the French bank Paribas was fined nearly $9 billion for you know, interactions with. Financial interactions, not just with Cuba, also with Sudan and Iran. And then, you know, the fines are just endless. If you read the Cuban motion to the United Nations General Assembly when they have their annual vote, it will list some of the fines, and they go up right to the end of the Obama administration. So it was a very sort of two-sided coin. Yeah,
relations.
Exactly.
I'm afraid I'd love to talk more on this topic, but we've run out of time on the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
The Limelight.
U.S. officials in Miami are calling for inspections of all older buildings over six stories within 45 days after the collapse of the Champlain Towers South apartment building that it is now feared to have killed potentially scores of people. Here we present you an article concerning this issue written by Amanda Holpach, under the heading, Miami Condo Collapse, Death Toll Rises to 10 as Search and Rescue Operations Continue. The article was published by The Guardian Daily. Please stay with us to hear more about the details. The rescue operation in the Miami suburb of Surfside continued. Officials urged people to maintain hope survivors might be found in the wreckage of a collapsed condo building. At a briefing, the Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava announced that a 10th person had been confirmed dead and 151 were still missing. No survivors had been found since Thursday, June 24th, in the ruins of Champlain Tower South, with rescue teams conducting round-the-clock searches. Levon Cava said they're out there with every resource that they need to ensure they can search this area, adding they can sweep the mound with dogs, with cameras, and sonar. The mayor said 135 residents had been accounted for and that the numbers of deceased and missing people were still very fluid. Andy Alvarez, a deputy incident commander with Miami-Dade Fire Rescue, told ABC on Monday, June 28, rescuers were still hopeful. Alvarez said, "This is a frantic search to continue to see that hope, that miracle, to see who we can bring out of this building alive." Alvarez said rescue teams found some voids in the wreckage, mostly in the basement and near the parking garage. Alvarez said, "We have over 80 rescuers at a time that are breaching the walls that collapse in a frantic effort to try to rescue those that are still viable and to get to those voids that we typically know exist in these buildings. Alvarez said conditions were not ideal because of humidity, rain, and heat. Alvarez noted, we are holding up because we are holding up for that hope, that faith, that we are going to be able to rescue somebody, adding, we are working tirelessly to try to bring victims that are underneath that rubble and rescue them. The search includes more than 300 emergency personnel, international expats, and equipment, including underground sonar systems. Efforts are also underway to determine the cause of the collapse. Structural engineers have identified several theories, but determining the cause could take months or years. In 2018, an engineer flagged concerns about major structural damage at the tower, but the report did not indicate the building was at risk of collapse. The engineering report dated 8 October 2018 appeared to have been discussed at a board meeting of Champlain Tower South Condominium Association the next month. According to meeting minutes obtained by NPR, at a November meeting, a Surfside building official said the building is in very good shape. The building collapsed at about 1:30 a.m. local time on Thursday, June 24th. No survivors have been found since the first hours following the collapse. Rescuers dug a trench 125 feet long, 20 feet across, and 40 feet deep overnight on Saturday, June 29th, and found remains, but no survivors. Families of the missing traveled by bus on Sunday, June 27th, to a site where they could watch rescue teams dig through the rubble and move large sections with cranes. An official who accompanied the families told the Miami Herald several people yelled the names of their loved ones in the hopes they might hear. Diane O'Hagan, whose parents Miriam and Arnie Nokin were in the building, told the Associated Press, we're just waiting for answers. That's what we want. It's hard to go through these long days and we haven't gotten any answers yet. Alan Kaminsky, chief of the Miami-Dade Fire Rescue Department, emphasized the operation must be slow and careful to protect rescuers as well as any survivors. Kaminsky said that we can't just go in and move things erratically because that's going to have the worst outcome possible. At a White House press briefing on Monday, June 28, the press secretary Jen Psaki said Joe Biden wanted the federal government involved in an investigation of the collapse. Officials from several federal bodies, including the FBI and Occupational Safety and Health Administration, have been deployed to the scene. Psaki said, we want to play any constructive role we can play with federal resources in getting to the bottom of it and preventing it from happening in the future. Surfside has hired a structural engineer, Alan Kushmer, who examined the Pentagon after it was attacked on 9/11 to study the tower collapse and the condition of nearby buildings. According to the town, Kushmer, founder and chief executive of KCE Structural Engineers, has toured the site and saw no visible evidence of any major structural concern. The Champlain Towers North Condominium Association has told the town it will hire its own structural engineering firm to investigate. The latest four victims identified by police were Christina Beatriz Elvira, 74, Leon Olikowitz, 80, Anna Ortiz, 46, and Luis Bermudez, 26. Bermudez lived on the 7th floor of the building with his mother, Ortiz. officials in Miami are calling for inspections of all older buildings over six stories within 45 days after the collapse of Champlain Tower South apartment building. The sudden failure of the building stunned the U.S., happening incredibly quickly and as most of its residents slept. According to CNN, the city of Miami sent letters on Friday, June 25th, to condo associations of 40-plus-year-old buildings above six stories, urging them to get an inspection from a qualified structural engineer within the next 45 days. The letter said, effective immediately, you are strongly urged to retain the services of a licensed structural engineer and to undertake a structural inspection for visible signs of distress. Miami-Dade and Surfside officials have vowed to release all documents relating to Champlain Towers to get to the bottom of what happened, as fires in the rubble have hampered efforts to reach possible survivors. Although the cause of the collapse remains to be unknown, engineering experts interviewed by the Miami Herald have said that, based on available evidence, it appeared that a structural column or concrete slab beneath the pool deck failed, creating a crater into which the midsection of the building collapsed. According to the minutes from a November 2018 board meeting obtained by the Miami Herald, Rosendo Prieto, the chief building official for the town of Surfside, told residents the condominium was in very good shape just a month after an engineer highlighted abandoned cracking in concrete columns, beams, and walls in a field survey report. The 136-unit building erected in 1981 collapsed before a recertification process was completed. But emails released by Surfside also show that Prieto dismissed concerns over potential damage to the building's foundation from a nearby construction project just 2 months after the engineer's report. According to the Washington Post, separately, developers of the complex were accused of contributing to at least two town board members' campaigns to get help with permits during construction in 1981. Champlain Towers were in a partnership with Polish-born Canadian Nathan Raber. According to Ontario's Hamilton Spectator, Raber was charged with tax evasion by Canadian authorities in the 1970s. In 1970, faced with a moratorium on construction in Surfside due to sewer system problems, rival developers with stalled projects complained that Raber's Champlain Towers project had received preferential treatment for permits. A year later, developers at Champlain requested that two members of Surfside's town council return political contributions that has been made to them after Raber's rivals went public. Raber died in 2014. Beyond immediate questions about the cause of the Champlain Towers collapse are broader questions of Miami's long beachfront development, often built on reclaimed land or sensitive barrier islands. Reports have identified parts of northeast Miami Beach where the ground has sunk, though experts stress it is far too early to make any meaningful guesses as to the exact cause of the collapse. Shimon Wedowinski, an environment professor at Florida International University, co-authored a paper in April last year that found the building had sunk by about 2 millimeters per year since 1990s. Wedowinski said it came as no surprise given his research last year. He told USA Today, "I looked at it this morning and said, oh my God, we did detect that." A construction executive who has extensive experience building high-rises in New York told The Guardian that everything moves no matter where it is constructed. He said, "Sure, buildings in Florida take a beating from the hurricanes and rain. If corners were cut, they will have to investigate what was in the ground and what kind of foundations was it built on."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Spotlight. Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kavit Akwe. The war in Yemen is now in its seventh year. The warring sides have failed to reach any compromise to end the war. The National Salvation Government accuses the Saudis of not offering a real solution, like failing to offer the lifting of the siege on Hodeidah port. Meanwhile, the U.S. president has so far only really pledged not to give the Saudis what he said were offensive weapons, but rather defensive ones, which many have dismissed outright as not even close to a real solution. Stay tuned to the Spotlight.
Marib has been the scene of intense fighting since February. Leading the offensive on the strategic city are the Yemeni army and its allied Ansarullah movement and fighters from the popular committees. They are trying to reclaim the oil-rich region from Saudi and UAE-backed mercenaries as well as former regime loyalists. In the latest escalation, the Yemeni armed forces and their allies fired ballistic missiles against sensitive military targets in Marib, the last major stronghold of Saudi-backed forces. Dozens were killed or wounded. But why has Yemen been embroiled in a spiral of deadly conflict? The roots of the bloodshed go way back to the year 2015. Then transitional president Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi resigned in the face of mass protests against a faltering economy and a decision to curb fuel subsidies. He was placed under house arrest but escaped to Saudi Arabia shortly after, retracting his resignation. In March 2015, Riyadh assembled a coalition of 9 Arab countries and launched an onslaught on its impoverished southern neighbor. The campaign enjoyed direct support from the West, especially the US and the UK. The aim? Restore Hadi to power. What Riyadh expected to achieve in a few weeks has not happened after more than 6 years. Instead, death and chaos run rife. Saudi warplanes have pounded Yemen regularly since the start of the war. The conflict, perpetuated by a crippling sea, air, and land blockade, has considerably worsened the condition in Yemen, which was reeling from poverty even before the war. Tens of thousands have been killed and millions displaced. Famine is now threatening a large portion of the population. Nearly 4 out of 5 Yemenis rely on aid for survival. The United Nations calls it the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. The war has left Yemen nearly destroyed. The country is in urgent need of peace, but it is not clear whether Riyadh is willing to exit from its self-created quagmire anytime soon.
Joining us in the spotlight for this edition, activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti joins us from Sana'a. And also Elijah Magnier, who's a political analyst, joins us from Brussels. I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Hossein Al-Bukhaiti. We're looking at the battle to have restarted for Maghreb, which is an oil-rich region. If you can, please set this up for us. Why Maghreb is important? What is the significance of this area? And in the bigger picture, in terms of the significance vis-a-vis the peace talks, if there are going to be any, how that plays into it.
First of all, I can explain why Maghreb is important. It's because that Maghreb is one of the largest and last cities that's under the control of the Saudi-backed forces. And in Maghreb as well, the Saudi, when they start the war on Yemen, they start their ground attack from Maghreb, and the operation room of the Saudi coalition is in Maghreb. That's why Maghreb is in the east of Sana'a, and it was used to attack Sana'a and to attack other area. That's why it's important for Yemeni forces here in Sana'a to liberate Maghreb. And on the top of that, when they have advanced toward Maghreb, they have put an initiative to the government in Maghreb, saying that they will stop all the attack if Maghreb and the government there will not allow the city to be a base for foreign troops and for Saudi-backed forces to attack any areas in Yemen and to open the road, and as well that the oil and gas in Maghreb should be distributed towards all Yemeni equally, despite in what area they are, either in areas under the control of the so-called Hadi government or under the control of Sana'a. But of course that the Saudi-backed forces has refused that, and now we are seeing them that they are crying out loud and they about this attack, and they totally forgot that the war on Yemen was launched in 2015, and that Yemeni army here in Sana'a, they have the right to liberate every corner in Yemen. And as Sayyid Abdul Malik Al-Houthi have said many times, and Muhammad Al-Houthi and all Yemeni political and military leaders, that they will liberate all areas in Maghreb. But at this point, we see that the United Nations and U.S. and other countries who are actually profiting from this war, they are crying out loud about Maghreb, and they said about millions of people who live in Maghreb, and this is actually a big lie. Before the war, there was 300,000 who are in Maghreb, not city, Maghreb province, and maybe there is maybe 100 to 250,000 the so-called displaced people. But I want to just add, we've seen that the United Nations now trying to use this humanitarian, as they say, crisis in Maghreb as a weapon. They have actually bought those camps for those displaced people in the front line. They have put them in areas between Sana'a and as well between Maghreb city, instead of locating those camps in some other area. And about the oil, it's not the attack on Maghreb or to liberate it, is all, as some people say, because it's rich of gas and oil. Yemen is under blockade, so even if the Houthis or Sana'a has controlled the oil field in Maghreb, they cannot export that oil. So there is no main goal to go behind this oil field.
Well, Elijah Magnier, a very good point, I believe, Hossein Al-Bukhaiti has raised there, and that's about the fact that you have an area by the name of Maghreb that was really not well known when this war was ongoing, now entering its seventh year. And then when you look at the way that Saudi Arabia is losing this war militarily, and when it comes to Maghreb and how the Saudi fighters are making advances there, all of a sudden it's in the news, it's in the spotlight. The Ansarullah are thwarting any peace efforts, and a huge deal is being made out of it. Why is Maghreb becoming this flashpoint when it comes to the bigger picture for Yemen?
Thank you for having me. Maghreb is important because it's the last Saudi stronghold but it is more important not because of that. It's more important because the Americans are negotiating today on behalf of the Saudis. They are the ones who are involved in this war directly, and they believe that the Houthis' victory is going to belong not to Yemeni people only, but also to Iran. And the Americans cannot accept or digest that Iran has won in Syria, has won in Iraq, and is going to win in Yemen, and they are going to lose their area of control and power and hegemony in the whole area of the Middle East, at the exception of the Gulf countries. This is what it's about. It is about a city that is rich of oil, that is Al-Hudaydah is not receiving more than 10 ships, despite the agreement of the UN inspectors and allowing these ships to go through. The Americans are carrying out this blockade against the Yemeni people. Now, we hear a lot of talk about the humanitarian aspect of marriage, which reminds me of the war in Syria in Idlib, where mainstream media is talking about the humanitarian aspect of the war and why Idlib is surrounded. Well, why are we not talking about the millions of Yemeni living in Sana'a and in other side of the city that is the country that is under the control of Ansarullah, that are under the siege of the Americans and under the Saudi bombardment? That also concerns the humanitarian aspect and those concerned about the humanitarian supply to Yemen. Therefore, what we see here is the Americans are refusing to give the upper hand to Ansarullah that are winning this war, and the fall of Marib means the defeat of Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia will lose its face and will no longer be representing anything in the Middle East. They've lost against Qatar, they've lost against Yemen, they've lost in Syria, they give a damn about Lebanon, so they are out politically, and that is their last stronghold.
Hossein Abaghaiti, if we were to go back to March, that is when the Saudis actually offered a peace deal, if my month is correct here, to the National Salvation Government. Many believe that that's because Saudi Arabia and its mercenaries on the ground there are losing the war militarily. Is that an exaggeration, or is that actually true? Is that the reason why the Saudis actually offered the peace deal? What does that show when they were the ones that came out first offering this peace deal?
This is exactly what's happening. We remember that when Saudi backed forces had the upper hand and the Saudi coalition, they were a few kilometers east of Sana'a in Nahim area, and they were threatened to enter the city. And we haven't seen, despite there are maybe 4 million civilians who live in Sana'a, we haven't seen any of this type of crying out loud about Marib. And to offer a peace deal that the Saudi actually, they want to deceive the international community. Either most of the UN and as well UN Security Council are actually fully supporting this war against Yemen. But the goal of that just to show that they really wanted peace in Yemen, and they want to negotiate with Sana'a. But if we look to the articles or what the Saudi has released in that peace deal, they still consider it as a civil war. They don't want to be in front for any negotiation directly with Sana'a forces, but they won't use that as they use now the humanitarian crisis to deceive the international community and to have more pressure and to get United States more involved in the war. But if the Saudi really wanted any peace with Yemen, because they are actually losing the war, that's why they use the humanitarian situation either in Marib or as well in Yemen as a weapons. Not lifting the blockade, not opening any of the airport, either in Sana'a or in other area, and they show that they have actually lost or military, and they have lost as well politically, but they still try by using the United Nations and the U.S. to have pressure on Sana'a to give up or to gain goals that they have actually lost by this war. And I believe that if Sana'a actually will continue to attack Saudi Arabia, not only attacking or liberating Marib, they have actually to attack Saudi Arabia, because that's the only way that they can bring down Saudi Arabia. And we have seen now how during Biden administration, the blockade has been tightened against Yemen. There are less and fuel ships and humanitarian ships that are reaching Hodeidah, despite the fact there is an agreement in Stockholm to allow all the ships to enter Hodeidah, because Sana'a has actually withdrawn from Hodeidah port and other area. And the main goal of the war, just last point, is actually divide and conquer. They want to separate Yemen, north and south, and as well they want to separate the south. And we have seen United Arab Emirates, they have created a group that actually doesn't recognize Hadi legitimacy. And if United Arab Emirates and Saudi and U.S. really wanted peace in Yemen, they should actually have restored Hadi government either in Aden or in Marib. But they haven't actually done that, and they want Sana'a to recognize this government. That's why the main goal is to implement the Saudi and as well U.S. and U.K. and the Zionist state policies in our region by controlling the south, controlling the coastline, and they want Marib to stay without any liberation. So Yemenis in the north will be fighting each other, and they cannot actually liberate the south. But Sana'a now have the upper hand, and they can stop that by continuing attack against Saudi Arabia.
Well, Elijah Magnier, you know, when you look at the facts of why Ansarullah for the National Salvation Government overall rejected the peace deal, it was some of the points made there by our guest from Sana'a, Hossein Abdelkhaiti, who basically said that the elements of this so-called offer, like the reopening of Sana'a Airport or the unlimited access to Hodeidah Port, that those were not terms that Saudi Arabia was ready to settle down with. And that's when you had the wrath come down from the UN envoy and said the National Salvation Government, they don't want peace deal, they want to continue the war. Do you think that was a mistake for the Ansarullah and the National Salvation Government to not accept the peace deal that was offered to them?
Absolutely not. The U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen, Tim Lander King, is trying to negotiate humanitarian support in exchange of a ceasefire. And he can't do that because humanitarian support is separated from the ceasefire and the end of the war. If the Saudis and the Americans, and we better talk about the Americans rather than the Saudis, because Saudis here are very marginal. If the Americans are willing to stop the war, they lift all sanctions, they lift all siege, the maritime siege, the airport, and they allow the supply to enter to Yemen through Hodeidah and through Sana'a Airport. And then they can sit and talk about the ceasefire, and they have to stop bombing, because Saudi Arabia hasn't stopped bombing Yemen until today. Therefore, they are not serious in asking for a ceasefire and blaming Ansarullah of not accepting the deal. There is no deal so far. What they are offering is, we give you food and you stop the ceasefire, we stop firing at us. This is not a deal. There is no deal under the table that is acceptable by Ansarullah.
So Hossein Abdelkhaiti, since we don't have much time left, I'm going to get right to the point of Marib. And let's imagine, hypothetically speaking, that the Ansarullah fighters make their advancements and retake that region, which, as you mentioned, is the last stronghold. They control the north and central highlands. So with the win, hypothetically speaking, of Marib, could they dictate the terms and the timing of a potential peace agreement?
Sana'a can dictate any terms to end this war, and they have actually put many initiatives saying that the war must stop, and that the blockade should be lifted, and that all foreign troops should actually leave Yemen, and they can do that by attacking Saudi Arabia. But one of the main idea for the Saudi coalition, why they have actually doesn't want Marib to fall, because as you said, if Marib will be liberated, this means that there is no more fighting between Yemeni in the north, and then Sana'a will focus actually on liberating the coast of Yemen, to liberate as well south and east of Yemen from the Saudi-backed forces. And if the war on Marib will continue as it like now, and if there is no serious step to liberate the city, this means that the Saudi actually have won the war in Yemen by dividing all country, by making Yemenis to fight each other. And I think that the United States and other country, if they really wanted peace in Yemen, Sana'a still have this deal on the table that Saudi should stop all its attack in return that Yemen will stop their attack against Saudi Arabia or against forces inside Yemen.
Okay, final question goes to you, Elijah Magnier. You had about 10 days ago or so the U.S. making an announcement that is pulling out THAAD missile systems and military arsenal and equipment out of the West Asia region, and included countries like Saudi Arabia, like Jordan. That doesn't quite go with the scenario that's unfolding still in Yemen in terms of the war continuing. I've always wondered, and I've asked this question throughout the war, and I'm going to ask this question again. Do you think that this war would end with one phone call from the U.S. to Saudi Arabia?
Yes, I do believe so. I believe the Americans, the one who are negotiating today on behalf of Saudi Arabia, can end the war anytime. The Saudis don't have the upper hand. They don't have the authority to negotiate and to end the war in Yemen. It's an American war, and it's bigger than Yemen. It goes to bigger picture, what is happening in the whole Middle East and the rearrangement of the Middle East. And who is going to control what? We see China and Russia moving in, and Russia is moving in aggressively. So the Americans are feeling the heat under their feet, and this is why they are afraid of what's going to happen next and who's going to win in Yemen. And they want to try and strike a deal. That's why they want to end this war by winning, and the Ansarullah are not allowing them to win because they've started their aggression in 2015. They have to end it today.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We do appreciate your comments there. That was Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Thank you. Hossein Ebreti, thank you so much. Activist and political commentator there from Sana'a. And with that, we come to an end of this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kavitavai, entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.